Today at Reader's Corner, Bryce Andrews, author of Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West.
As the West evolves, I think that ranchers, even traditional ranchers, are starting to understand the value of a functioning, healthy ecosystem. One of the things the Sun Ranch experience taught me is that the landscape's fundamental qualities are beauty and brutality. The first large animal I ever killed was a wolf, and I killed it with a borrowed gun that I'd never shot before. That was a really difficult thing for me, and a really difficult thing to square with after the fact. You look at the way the wolves came back, ranchers have been asked to bear an incredibly unfair share of the burden of reintroduction, and they reap very few of the benefits.
I'm Bob Custer, president of Boise State University. Welcome to Reader's Corner. During the summer of 2007, a city kid from Seattle lived out an adventure most wannabe cowboys only dream of. Bryce Andrews spent a year working on the Sun Ranch, an expansive area of rangeland in the breathtaking wilderness of southwest Montana. He was mending fences, riding horses, roping cattle, and transforming himself into a true ranch hand. It fulfilled his heart's desire to live among the wild, and as Mr. Andrews writes, it might have been a simple, pretty story, if not for the wolves. In his gripping memoir, Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West, Mr. Andrews takes us through a grueling year on the remote ranch. He introduces us to its high valleys and mountain peaks and carries us along on his inescapable collision course with a wolf, and a decision that would haunt him long after the encounter. Today we're featuring an encore edition of our interview with Bryce Andrews. Mr. Andrews was born in Seattle. He lives and writes from southwest Montana, where he manages a conservation-oriented cattle ranch and spends a great deal of time considering and tending to the needs of animals. Mr. Andrews joins us by phone from Missoula, Montana for this interview. Bryce Andrews, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much for having me, Bob.
Well, Bryce, one of the questions I always get from our listeners whenever I run across them out in the community is, where do you get all these ideas for your books? And my usual answer is that I hang out at bookstores and I read book reviews, and staff that works with me reads book reviews. But in this particular case, it was all very different, as you so well know, because I was spending some time on Whidbey Island in Puget Sound, and I went to a dinner. And your mother was there, and when she learned about my radio show, she said, oh, that's interesting. My son has this book. And a few weeks later, I had a copy of the book, and here we are talking about your book. Now, how does a kid who grows up on the water, so to speak, find his way to Montana to be a ranch hand?
Well, that's a great question, and a person should never underestimate the wonderful advocate that a mother can be even later on in life.
That's right.
I did, in fact, grow up in the Pacific Northwest, and I actually grew up mostly in Seattle, in the urban heart of Seattle. So I grew up about as far away from the world of ranching and the greater Yellowstone ecosystem as a person could. My mother, who you mentioned, was a photographer. My dad ran the University of Washington's Art Museum for almost all of my childhood. So I grew up very much in that world. And the thing that finally connected me to the West, for lack of a better word for it, to ranching, is that, well, two things. My dad curated a show at the Henry Art Gallery there in Seattle that was called The Myth of the West. And they had basically the entire, history of art from the West. You had, old stuff like Bierstadt and Moran and all the way up through Andy Warhol's Double Elvis, that big print. And I remember looking at that art and just thinking it was so alien to the world that I knew, but at the same time I knew that I was curious and that I wanted to know more about it. Now, my dad also, my mom and dad actually developed a close relationship with the Zents family. Pat Zents is a sculptor, and the Zents family ranches and has for several generations just outside of Billings. So I started to work for them when I was a little kid and just really fell in love with working with my hands, with being outdoors, and really the idea that you could shape a landscape without destroying what was naturally going on there to begin with. So that was kind of my introduction and what drew me toward Montana initially.
So help us locate the Sun Ranch geographically. What's the location of this book?
Well, probably the best way to describe it is, you know, the Sun Ranch sits not too far off of the northwest corner of Yellowstone Park. It's at the very south end of the Madison Valley, which roughly drops south from Bozeman. So the Sun Ranch was at the highest, most remote corner of that valley, bordering the Lee Metcalf Wilderness, which in turn runs back toward the park.
So that's part of what people call the Yellowstone ecosystem, including everything like grizzlies.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that's one of the things that's really unique about that place is now with the reintroduction of the wolves, pretty much everything that used to live there lives there again. You know, that's the situation that's not without its complexity, as the book kind of explores.
Now, the Sun Ranch was advertised as being committed to conservation, improving the health of the land for wildlife and livestock through progressive management. How common is it today for large ranching operations like the Sun Ranch to have that particular commitment to conservation management?
I think it's definitely growing more common for a couple of very different reasons. First, you have this continual influx of, I guess I'd call them recreational or amenity buyers. So you have people who are buying land and not buying it because they think they're going to make their living off of agriculture or produce a traditional product from the land, like cows or wheat or whatever. So you've got that. And those people, I think, generally are a little bit more interested in the value of conservation. But on the other hand, I think this is the more important part of it. You know, as the West evolves, as our region becomes more crowded, more complicated, and frankly more interesting, I think that ranchers, even traditional ranchers, are starting to understand the value of a functioning, healthy ecosystem and what that can bring to their operation. So I think people are very, very curious about the way conservation and agriculture are going to come together. And frankly, I think it's one of the most important things we've got to figure out in the next couple decades here in the West.
So to your first point about people coming into Montana, for example, and buying ranches, buying land, who are not particularly interested in profiting from them as much as saving them, let's say, isn't that where Roger comes in, the guy in your book? Tell us about Roger, who actually, I guess, is the owner of this operation.
Yeah, so Roger was the owner at the time, doesn't own it anymore, but very interesting guy. He made his money outside of the world of ranching and came in. You know, in a lot of ways, I see similarities to what drew him to the place and what drew me to the place. We just had very different circumstances when we came. You know, we both loved fishing, so we came first to the Madison as fishermen. You know, and I think he came with a sense that, I mean, I don't mean to put words in his mouth, but I feel like he felt a responsibility for having done really well in business and wanted to do something truly good and of lasting importance for a landscape that he cared about. So he ended up buying, you know, one of the most incredible chunks of land I've ever been around. I mean, the Sun Ranch was 18,000 deeded acres with some leases on top of that, of some of the most intact habitat and also some of the most productive grazing land in that part of the world. So he was very and remains very committed to figuring out ways to integrate sustainable agriculture with a functioning natural system. I respect that.
I mentioned to you before we started talking here on the interview that this show is broadcast across southern Idaho and central Idaho, where I would suspect, I think I have this on pretty good authority, that most of the ranching operations are about people trying to eke out a living. It's not about people like Roger. There may be a few of those in Idaho, but I suspect from what I've read, you might have a few more of them in Montana than you do in Idaho. So how's a guy like Roger accepted, or does it make any difference, in the larger ranching community in Montana or in Montana's culture and politics? It sounds to me like some of Roger's thinking is going to be pretty foreign to folks that from generation to generation have been simply focused on how to use this land to make a profit and raise a family.
Yeah, I think that's a huge source of tension in our communities, and certainly, you know, the culture and the politics of rural Montana is by no means monolithic. You know, you've got a lot of individuals with a lot of crazy and not so crazy ways of thinking about the world, all thrown together on a landscape that throws a lot of complexity and a lot of weird different situations at you. So I think that somebody in Roger's position, or somebody in my position, because I don't come from a ranching background, and I certainly started my work in this part of the world with a different set of assumptions about the way the world should be and the way it is than a lot of my friends who grew up in these places. I think the best thing a person in my situation or Roger's has going for us is the ability to develop a deep and honest sympathy for the work of ranching and how difficult it can be to make a living from a landscape that at its heart is pretty austere and pretty arid and sometimes pretty difficult to make a living from. And you mentioned the fact that a lot of ranchers exist on the thinnest of margins. And that, I think, is why the wolf thing in particular is so challenging for a lot of people. If you look at the way the wolves came back, ranchers have been asked to bear an incredibly unfair share of the burden of reintroduction, and they reap very few of the benefits. And I think that's a really difficult thing for anybody to swallow, and it's exceptionally difficult if you have a business that exists on a really thin margin, like ranching. So mm-hmm. I view our task collectively as trying to increase that margin for the ranchers that are doing right by the land.
You're listening to Bryce Andrews. He's the author of Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West. So tell us about the Sun Ranch and its green ranching operation. What does that mean? What happens on the ranch you worked on? And again, you're on one right now, if I understand the bio correctly. You're working on something in southwest Montana, isn't that right? A conservation-oriented cattle ranch?
Actually, and we can get into this a little later. I'm actually in the process with a friend of for the first time, trying to do this work for myself rather than for someone else. We're actually in the process of leasing a ranch, which I can certainly get into a little bit later. But you asked about what were we doing on the Sun Ranch?
Yeah.
So the Sun Ranch was set up in kind of an interesting way. Being as it was at or above 6,800 feet, it was really good summer grazing country. We didn't winter cattle there. We brought in between 1,400 and 1,500 head of yearling steers and heifers each year, and we grazed them through the summer months. We were trying to use those cattle to fill an existing ecological niche, the one historically filled by bison and elk. So we wanted to rotate them across the landscape using management-intensive grazing practices, using accurate and thorough range management practices, so that we were cycling them across the land, using them to reinvigorate the soil and the plants, and trying to use our livestock to the benefit of the land rather than to its detriment. At the same time, there was a huge and explicit focus on living well with predator species, particularly the wolves, because we did have a resident pack. So a lot of our work on that place revolved around trying to graze our cattle in this extremely wild, difficult landscape, and at the same time protect them and avoid conflict with wolves. I guess last but not least, the ranch was doing some interesting things with leasing stock water and irrigation water to provide more in-stream flow for native fish. And there were also some development easements that were placed on the property. So I guess that kind of sums up the conservation aspects of it.
Can I assume that it is more costly from the standpoint of the individual rancher to do these things you're doing than those out there who are just doing it, like I said, trying to raise a family? Or is that not the case? How does that work?
Well, certainly short term, it seems more cost effective to do it without worrying about all this ecological stuff. But I think you can make a really strong argument that one of the things that we've seen over and over again in our part of the world is that you've got a family on the land, and they ask, every year they're asking the most they can of it because they're trying to make a living and live on the thinnest margin possible. And I think a person only has to look around, at least in my part of the state and my part of the region, to see a lot of chunks of property, a lot of big chunks of land that are exhausted, places that have historically been overgrazed or that have seen some really difficult issues with weeds. So I think when you start to look at the long term, then you start to really see the value in some of these conservation practices. Because, if I've got two sections of grassland and I've taken good care of them, over time, those sections of grassland are going to be able to run cattle consistently into the future. Whereas if I've been asking too much of them, then their ability to carry cows or anything else, wildlife included, goes down over time. Productivity goes down over time, mm-hmm. which I think is what breaks a lot of family ranches.
So let's talk a little bit about your experience on the ranch. I really got a kick out of learning more about James and Jeremy because, of course, we all have this mythical image of the cowboy. And then I'm reading you describe James, and James reads Wendell Berry, and I thought, uh-oh, this is not your father's Oldsmobile. This guy's different than the mythical image of the cowboy. I wouldn't have expected him to be reading Wendell Berry. Tell us about these guys.
Well, yeah, and so Jeremy was the one reading Wendell Berry.
Oh, okay.
Both guys are really interesting, and both people that I truly appreciated the chance to learn from. You know, Jeremy was the foreman on the ranch, and really was a mentor in the sense that he had the whole picture in his head, and that was something that took me a long time to understand. You're not just thinking about the herd, but you're thinking about the way wild animals are moving across the landscape too. I always remember Jeremy, you know, I always just thought, God, this guy is in a hurry everywhere he goes. is and remains a friend, you know, is one of the most efficient people that I've ever run across. So working with him was a real education for me. And working with James was an education too, in a totally different way, because James was the other ranch hand on the place that summer. But James was better than I was at everything. You know, it was sort of a kind of a big brother, little brother thing. Everything I could do, James could do better. And and I really, really appreciated the chance to learn from him. We came from very different backgrounds. You know, I obviously came from urban Seattle, and James came from a Mormon family in Southeast Idaho. But working with James, not only did we bring together some really different perspectives on a lot of things, which we talked about at length, you know, I always respected his devotion to the animals, to the livestock, and his ability to understand how the world looked to a cow. And that may not sound like a very important thing, but it really is if you've got to move hundreds of them through a really tough landscape.
Well, one of the things that brings up is, I believe it was Jeremy that finally dealt with a heifer that was a bit out of control. And that was a pretty violent moment in your young ranch life, as I remember.
Yeah, that was. So that's the bit with the heifer number 512. And this was a heifer that we were trying to move her. We're trying to move a whole bunch of these heifers across the highway from one pasture to another. There's a little highway that runs through parts of the ranch, and we got all these cattle moved except for this one, and she just got on the fight. You know, no matter what we did, she wouldn't move. She, you know, got dangerous. She came after the horses. And finally, we roped her, and she hit the ground. She was done. She was stubborn. She wouldn't move. And things did get really, really rough with her. And that was the first time I'd ever been exposed to having somebody that I really respected snap and sort of have to be violent. Now, I think a person has to keep context in mind. One of the things I didn't know at the time, but I came to understand later, is that James had seen a situation like this before. He was working for a guy, and the guy left one cow back on the wrong side of the highway. And this cow actually, later in the night, decided she wanted to be with the herd, fought her way onto the highway, and killed a motorist. The motorist hit the cow. So in James and Jeremy's mind, I think leaving that heifer back was not an option, because it put people in danger, and it also put that heifer in grave danger, because that landscape was so full of predators that leaving an animal behind sometimes was tantamount to offering her up as a sacrifice. A difficult situation, certainly, but one that's not quite as simple as it seemed to me at the time.
And that's really why I was going to ask you to follow up with the rest of the story, but you did it very effectively. I think it does show, as you say, the context of the story. So Bad Luck Canyon is where these wolves are hanging out. Tell us about Bad Luck Canyon and your first foray into there.
Yeah, well, Bad Luck Canyon, very interesting place. You know, Jeremy, when I first got to the ranch, he described it to me as Predator Alley, and I found it to be that. My first real exploration of that canyon was when I was up working on some stock water stuff, and I kind of finished up early, and I decided to walk up in there. And the thing that struck me about it first is that as you went into it, it became more foreboding. You started to see all these bones in the grass, you know, spines laying everywhere like weird snakes, and you know, the sides became steep. So steep in places that you would have had to get down on, you had to use all four of your limbs to climb out of there. And I walked up there, and certain places on the ranch were like that. That was one of the things I really had to learn as a city kid. There were certain places where the hair stood up on the back of your neck, and it mattered. I mean, you had to listen to that, because some of these places, you know, there were places where things died often. And, you know, bigger things than me died there, tougher things than me died there. So I walked up that creek and just really found it to be a place that was dark and dangerous, but somehow magnetic. It was interesting. And it was interesting because it was inhabited by creatures that I'd never really seen at the time. You know, the wolves, we knew the wolves were around. We had telemetry collars on a couple of the ones that the state had put on. So we knew that they were in the area. But for all that, you very seldom saw them.
Well, you ended up seeing one. Tell us about the confrontation with this wolf and what happened.
Yeah, sure. So midway through the summer, you know, we were pushing our cattle up, you know, moving from pasture to pasture as the grass greened up higher and higher. And as we did that, we could all feel that our margin for error was getting slimmer. And every day we're kicking these bunches of elk, you know, we're bumping them, we're running into them, and they're going high into the hills. And you sort of think, all right, every one of those is one less that the wolves have to prey on. And what happened was eventually the wolves turned to the cattle. They didn't follow the elk into the hills as they had in years past. And they began to maim and kill the heifers, particularly the heifers. And so the state issued two shoot on site permits for wolves, thinking that, you know, striking back against the pack would deter it to some extent. And for a long time, because I had no familiarity with guns or hunting or any of that because of my background, for a long time, James and Jeremy went out looking for the wolves, and I stayed back and I held down the fort. You know, I checked the water, I moved cows, I set out salt, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, one night I'd spent the night with the cattle, I was completely exhausted, and I decided that something snapped, and I guess I just could finally step across a line that I had really resisted stepping across. And so I told James and Jeremy that I'd go with them, and it was just blind, dumb luck. The first large animal I ever killed was a wolf, and I killed it with a borrowed gun that I'd never shot before. So that was a really difficult thing for me, and a really difficult thing to square with after the fact, because I came to that landscape because I liked ranching, but more than that, I came because I wanted to be close to the wild, and I wanted to be close to animals like the wolf. So that was a difficult thing for me to do, and one that I've had to square with after the fact.
Today we're talking about Bad Luck Way, a year on the ragged edge of the West. My guest is Bryce Andrews. Has anything changed regarding your perspective on that kill from the time you wrote the book until now?
Well,
You could share the perspective. I mean, you obviously come away from that experience troubled by what you had done, and yet, at the same time, which you've already stated in this interview, understanding the conflict and the challenge that ranchers have when it comes to wolves.
Right. Well, I think I have evolved in the way that I think about it. You know, I think one of the things the Sun Ranch experience taught me is that the two fundamental qualities of ranching in a place like that, or just living in a place that wild, the landscape's fundamental qualities are beauty and brutality. I believe that very strongly. You know, there's nothing as beautiful as the sound of wolves howling or elk talking back and forth, and there's nothing quite as brutal as seeing what can be done to a heifer by a pack that's hungry. So I guess I've changed in the way that I think about these things. Initially, I had a lot of revulsion just for the violence of it and the bloodshed and all that. And now I think I'm able to step back a little bit more. And when I step back, here's what I see. Ranchers can coexist with wolves. It's not pretty a lot of the time. It's not the bloodless, wonderful, happy peace that some of us would imagine it to be. But it can work. And every year, so long as the landscape stays open, every year we have a chance to do this better. Every summer can be better than the last summer. I'm not saying everyone will be, But as long as some of the wolves survive, and as long as those ranchers can keep holding on, we have hope and we have a chance for the future. I strongly believe that if we develop some of these landscapes, if they become fragmented with too many houses, too many roads, I think that hope winks out. So I guess what I'm saying is I still struggle with shooting that wolf, but I now understand how important it is for the wolves that ranches stay viable and the landscape stays open.
In the time you've had to share this book with prospective buyers of the book, like in bookstores or wherever, and whatever kinds of reactions you've had personally to the book, how have folks reacted? I mean, there's this huge wolf debate going on in Idaho right now, of course, as you know. And boy, I can see your book playing more than one way, that's for sure, in terms of what people take away from it and whether or not they agree with your perspective. Have you run into much of that as an author talking to readers?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The first thing I ever published was a little article in High Country News about this very thing, about shooting the wolf. And I published that a week before I started in the environmental studies program at the University of Montana. And I had people calling my landlord trying to get me thrown out. I had people trying to fight me drunkenly in the street. And with this book, I expect some measure of that, certainly. When I was sharing the book with people, I shared it with James from the book. His wife read it. He and his wife read it. And she said, you know, Bryce, this is a book that environmentalists are going to wave in our faces forever. And she said that from a place of love, and she's a friend. But that's how she took it. Now, the very next day, a respected conservationist and author from Seattle said, you know, this is the kind of book that ranchers are going to wave in our face forever. So you get, I think a lot of people don't know how to take this thing. And I think that comes from the fact that if there's anything that's sure in this book, it's that I have a deep and lasting respect for the life and the work of ranching, but I have an equivalent sympathy for wolves. And I'm not really willing to choose a side in any kind of a white or black way. And I think that's tough on people sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Your book is really a tribute to the ranching life and is just you do such a fine job of summing that all up. I guess I just wonder about you and your future. You alluded earlier in the interview to some plans you have, and you got your master's degree in environmental studies. You could probably carve out a career writing books like Bad Luck Way, but it sounds like you have some interests that are going to take you down this path of ranching.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, I'm working on a couple things. I'm writing another book, but I'm also, as I mentioned earlier, a friend and I are leasing a ranch kind of near Missoula here, and it's going to be neat. We're going to raise grass-fed beef to sell here in Missoula, but at the same time, I'm hoping to work with the university to build a ranch-based educational program that combines the day-to-day work of agriculture with the curriculum in writing, ethics, aesthetics, and science as they apply directly to the contemporary issues in the West. So this idea of combining ranching and the humanities and an educational component is really, really appealing to me. It's what I want to work on next.
Well, you've done a fine job of introducing those of us who are not that familiar with ranching life in Montana or Idaho or anywhere else in the West. You've done a great job with this book. Bryce, I can't thank you enough. Again, our author today is Bryce Andrews. The book is The Bad Luck Way, A Year on the Ragged Edge of the West. Bryce, thanks for joining us today at Reader's Corner.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Bob. I really, really appreciate it.
I hope you enjoyed this encore edition of our interview with Bryce Andrews. Next week, presidential historian Douglas Brinkley, author of The Wilderness Warrior, Theodore Roosevelt, and the Crusade for America, and the keynote speaker on October 19th at the 31st Annual Frank Church Conference on Public Affairs at Boise State. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones. Research by Sherry Squires. Our producer is Janelle Brown. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.